Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, December 24th, Christmas Eve 2015. This is not the last show of the year. There will be one more next week, December 31st, and a very important show. Tonight I'll introduce the topic, give some outlines, and then next week I'm going to have a special dedicated to my new release, which is a very big surprise for me. Probably a bigger surprise for me than it might be for you. But something happened. It's one of those things you just stumble upon, don't even know it when you're looking at it. Lots of other people have stumbled upon this and looked at it and not understood what they were looking at, needless to say. So next week, and this is a result of, I kind of disappeared for a few weeks, and people were wondering, well, gee, where's McCanny? Well, I spent 2 weeks in Peru. And you think, well, gee, that guy must be a millionaire. He traveled around for 2 weeks in Peru. Well, the way I travel, it really didn't cost much at all. And Peru is a very inexpensive place to be. So the total trip was extremely economical. I mean, most of you could not go to a weekend Hotel 6 for what I went to Peru on. And so at any rate, I'll explain a little bit about what I did. I flew to Lima, rented a car, and put 3,000 kilometers on in 11 days, not quite 2 weeks. And, of course, I visited the Inca sites, did a lot of extensive work there. But the discovery came out in the middle of nowhere, literally. And, I'm not going to say any more about that. But it really goes back to severe ancient history, something that only somebody with my background would really be able to pick up the pieces and put them together. So I'm not going to say any more about that next week. By the way, that release is in pre-sale right now on my webpage for $12. After next week's show, it's going to go up to $20. But you can also get it free if you order like $250 worth of any products from my website page. And remember that the sale that I have up for severely discounted water filter prices, 10 packs of water filters, etc., that sale will end also next Thursday, December 31st. And prices will go back to normal. And next year, I'm going into a whole new method of selling. There's a whole lot of changes that are coming about relative to my product line and things like that. So this sale will end December 31st, next Thursday, and you can get the new release. I'm not going to say titles, of course, or anything like that, because once I release this, as usual, the copycats would be all over it. And so, especially NASA and the main scientific community. My page got hacked, interestingly enough, while I was gone. It was December 12th. And we believe we know who did it. It came, of course, it always comes from a foreign country. It came from the Czech Republic and China. But my page got totally destroyed, my web page. And so due to this happening previously, we have checks and balances in place. So I was able to restore the page completely, put new security on it. And maybe the 16th or 17th, I believe, they got it back up and running. And so anyway, there may have been a week when you went to my webpage and got some kind of strange message or that there might be viruses or things like that. And I believe most people's computers would have blocked that. Just your basic operating system probably would have blocked it. But anyway, thank goodness that has been taken care of. But tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about the trip to Peru. What an amazing country. Here's a country with no GMO food, no herbicides, no pesticides, no mechanical agriculture, basically, so to speak. I saw one small tractor when I was there. It was down in a place actually getting close to Lima where they were growing, I believe, something like watermelons. But that little tractor could not really do a lot. It's all handwork. These fields are meticulously beautiful. And you see corn, you see potatoes, 350 varieties of potatoes in Peru. That's where the potato began. The Incas developed the potato. They also had corn. And they're still using the old strains. There are people there that still speak strictly Inca languages. They don't speak Spanish at all. And so, very interesting. Lake Titicaca, you can drink the water out of the lake. Now, Peru is a developing country. Every place you look, there is construction. Oh, I've never seen, I mean, I've been in a lot of third world countries, second world countries, and of course, a lot of the, what you call first world countries around the planet. And I've never seen anything like the development that is going on in Peru. It's a country that apparently the bankers forgot about. And tremendous, wonderful food, very inexpensive, wonderful people, very friendly. I went into the house of a native on Lake Titicaca and sat and talked with the owner of the house. They live on floating islands that they build. It's very interesting. And the indigenous people, the people that are still living the old-fashioned way, living and making the cloth, etc., living like the people did 100, 200, 500 years ago, we are going to make an effort to try and keep them living, to keep them living in the same manner that they're accustomed to. And so this is all going on in the background. I have so many things going on in the background that it's not funny. But the trip to Peru was a real eye-opener. When 3,000 kilometers by car through southern Peru, through the Andes Mountains, the Altiplano, which is, oh my goodness, and you know, hundreds of kilometers of elevated plain, that 12,000 to 14,000 foot elevation, absolutely incredible. The scenery, the mountains. Now, I've been in the Andes Mountains probably in almost all parts of it now after this particular trip. I've been south, I've been north, I've been through, and not only the Andes, but the Central Cordillera that comes up through Central America, all over the Central Cordillera, the Sierra Nevada, which runs through Central Mexico, up through the American Southwest, through the Colorado Rockies. I've been through there extensively, Montana, Alberta, Canada, etc. So I've been through probably the vast majority of that mountain range, which extends from the Yukon in Alaska all the way down to Tierra del Fuego, where it drops down into the ocean, and you have the Magellan Islands out there beyond Tierra del Fuego, the Straits of Magellan. So I've been up and down all of these, and I've come to a single conclusion about mountains. I have yet to see two mountains that are look alike. They're all different. There is a minimum, absolute minimum, of 20 major sessions of mountain building going on. This idea that plate tectonics, somehow the plates move and that forces the mountains to build, complete garbage. It could not possibly be true. The mountains are built when large comets come by, and basically the gravitational wave of the large comet nuclei wrenches the crust of Earth And when that gravitational wave comes and collides with the already existing mountain, and now it collides, and that energy is absorbed into the mountain range. Now imagine you're at the ocean. We've all seen this. You're at the ocean or a big lake. The waves are coming in. They're hitting the rocks, and boom, that wave explodes up into the air, and that energy just goes wild. And it's something that gets a lot of oohs and ahs when we're watching the ocean or big waves. But imagine a land wave coming in 300 feet tall or 1,000 feet tall. And this is at the gravitational wave. The source of this energy is the gravitational wave from a large passing comet. And that wave comes in the land mass of the Earth, in the crust, in the mantle. And as that wave comes along and it hits that mountain range, all that energy just explodes, throws that mountain up. I've talked a number of weeks ago about the fallacy of plate tectonics, that it simply doesn't work. The example I gave was, how do you get enough energy to push that mountain range up into the air? And you simply don't, because lateral forces do not translate well perpendicularly. Where's the energy source that pushes these plates around? Certainly we see tectonic movement, plate movement and boundary movement, but that's because Earth had a big jarring here a number of thousands of years ago, and these plates are just recovering, so they're starting to relax and move back, getting back to normal, so to speak. So at any rate, the point is that the Andes Mountains, from north to south, and like I said, I've been from the Canadian Rockies up in Alberta into Montana, into Wyoming, into Colorado, into the southwestern United States. I've flown over these. I have my 110 high-resolution photos of the American Southwest. I've been all over the Sierra Nevada that runs down through Mexico, down through Central America, mixed with volcanic activity, down into through Panama, into Colombia, the three mountain ranges of Colombia, into Ecuador, and now into Peru, and then south down to the border when I did my Harrington expedition. So I've been all over these mountains, and the one thing I can safely say is there are no two mountains alike. That's the final conclusion. One last note on mountains is that you consistently see land that was built under the ocean, thrown up at the highest levels of the Andes Mountains or in the Rockies or wherever you are. You see land that was formed down at the bottom of the ocean, and now it's sitting at the tippity top of the tallest mountain range in the world. So I'll talk a little bit more about this, other related topics of my travels here. But I wanted to tell you why I went to Peru. Now, I probably have 10 major reasons, but of those 10, there were two primary reasons. The first is that I was speccing out Peru for the Wing Generator Project, because it's a country that, first of all, cannot afford nuclear power. It cannot afford it. Most of its power comes from hydro. But it cannot afford, and by the way, in Lima, the source of power for automobiles is primary LP, bottled gas or natural gas, pressurized natural gas. And so they really don't have a big energy issue. In terms of energy, natural gas or LP or propane is a wonderful source of fuel, because there's no processing. It just comes out of the ground. You pressurize it, put it in a tank. When you burn it, it turns into carbon dioxide and water. And by the way, I'm of a group of people that we're now promoting, CO2 is a very good thing for this planet. There's no such thing as a greenhouse effect. The plants love CO2. The more CO2 we put into the air, the better. The plants will, right now, the plants on this planet are dying. they need significant amount of CO2. So it's really not, in a, especially in an environment like Peru, it's not a pollutant. There's no lead in it. There's no gasoline is a horrible, horrible pollutant. But LP gas or natural gas or propane, very good source of fuel, very clean burning. And carbon dioxide is not an issue. Global warming is not an issue. Global climate change is not an issue. That's all garbage science. So at any rate, the wing generator, however, would be able to power, literally power a country like Peru overnight. They're not going to have enough money to buy into, for example, say like Germany or the Netherlands, who invested heavily, or Britain, who have invested heavily into the useless three-blade wind generators, which don't work. And now they're finding out the hard way. But a country like Peru doesn't have the luxury of money. And so that's wonderful, because the scammers who sell the three-blade wind generators won't be able to scam that country. They wouldn't be able to buy more than a couple. But Peru needs wind power, and that's where my wing generator comes in, and that's why I went there, because it's a ripe market, and we can install these for far, far less than the stupid three-blade wind generators. They will produce energy, and especially in the remote communities, you know, like I say, you come up over a mountain in a desert, very dry area, and you find a valley completely lush with irrigation, growing tremendous crops, maybe a valley that's 20 miles long and maybe 5 miles wide, just green with food. And so these people live in a wealth of water, clean water, food, no GMO food, no herbicides, no pesticides, no GMO. I wanted to tell the story about a man I met in a restaurant. I went into a restaurant and to grab something for the road to eat and something to drink on the road. And there was a man there, and people were so wonderful. They'd stand up and shake your hand. They just wanted to talk to you, and they'd hardly would let you out the door. They wanted to talk. But this one guy says, "I want to talk to you about seeds." And I go, "What?" He goes, "Seeds. Can you get me seeds? I want any kind of seeds you can get me, you know, for crops, for agriculture." And in fact, I was looking for seeds at the time also from them. And so, in fact, I did make some exchanges during the trip, not with that particular gentleman. But I said, "Look, the most of the places where we could get seeds to you from other countries are GMO." And he looked at me and he says, "I don't want anything to do with GMO. I don't want any transgenetic modified, anything like that. We don't grow anything like that here in Peru. They have 350 varieties of potatoes, the corn, many varieties of corn, no hybrid, no GMO, no herbicides, no Roundup Ready, no Roundup, no insecticides, nothing. All the work is done by hand. Just amazing. I'm just astounded. The food is wonderful. It's clean. You can drink the water out of the streams and rivers. Lake Titicaca is so clean that you can drink the water. You just stick a glass in it and drink it. Peru is a wonderful, clean, friendly, very dynamic country, developing. Every place you look, tremendous construction going on, unbelievable amounts of construction using earth materials. So just, I'm just very impressed with Peru. So number one reason for me going there was, and putting 3,000 kilometers on in 11 days, was to spec out the wing generator project. And so that is moving forward. Number two reason for going there was to scope out the desert, the very dry, arid conditions that are occurring right now. And this is because this is the second year that the so-called El Nino effect, the heating of the Pacific Ocean, which scientists don't understand. They don't understand what causes it. It's a plasma effect. The heating of the Pacific Ocean is caused by electrical currents from outer space. It's Joule heating. And they don't understand that. But here's the story, and I've talked about this before. I'll try and summarize it quickly. Hundreds of years ago, the fishermen who lived along the west coast of South America, Ecuador, Colombia, Peru, primarily near the equator, noticed that during Christmas time, there were sometimes unusually rainy weather, persistent rainy weather patterns. And so they called it El Nino, after the Christ child, El Nino meaning the child. But of course, at Christmas time, El Nino literally means the Christ child, highly Christian area of the world. And so anyway, along comes modern science, boondoggle tier two fairy tale science, and they notice empirically that along with the rainy seasons, there seems to be an association with the heating of the Pacific Ocean at the same time, because they had just discovered this heating of the Pacific Ocean phenomena due to satellite data. You can see it. Sometimes within a day, the entire surface of the Pacific Ocean along the central part will heat up 1 or 2 or even 3 degrees centigrade in a matter of a day. It's a tremendous heating effect. It does not come from below. It's not coming from a volcanic source deep in the ocean or something like that. It's surface heating. So it's a plasma effect. And so anyway, they associated this with this rainy period, and it worked for about 2 or 3 years. And so then they generalized it, and then they started throwing it in and everything in the kitchen sink, including it into the Atlantic hurricane season. Everything was caused by El Nino. A catchphrase, but once again, very bad science. So anyway, last year, not this current year, Christmas, but a year ago, there was no heating of the Pacific Ocean. Yet, South America along the Pacific coast had the rainiest season in history. It was a deluge. And I personally went and studied this. Okay, so now we have 1 year where the El Nino effect does not work. Year number two this year, there is heating of the Pacific Ocean. In fact, it's a near record heating of the Pacific Ocean. And they're experiencing severe drought. In fact, the most severe drought in history, where the rivers are bone dry. In every place I went, I asked about the water conditions. They said, you see that river there? That should be flowing constantly with water. And it's not. The snow-capped mountains are not nearly as snow-capped as they should be. And being summertime, this should be their rainy period. When I went to Machu Picchu, you can see a couple of pictures on my homepage, it was extremely sunny. The story is that Machu Picchu should be raining every day. It's in the tropical rainforest, even though it's at an elevation of about 7,000 feet. It's in the middle of a tropical rainforest, and so it rains there literally every day. But when I was there, it was bone dry, perfect blue sky. And I went during the middle of the low season, the low tourist season, and there was really nobody there. It was like me and the alpacas in Machu Picchu. It was wonderful. So I got tremendous photos, just like, you know, like a ability to get all of these photos without any people in them. I did a lot of studying of not only Machu Picchu, but the other Inca sites, and that's a whole story in itself. At any rate, the second reason I went there was to confirm the severe drought that's going on this year, Christmas 2015, is exactly the opposite effect that should be taking place according to modern fairy tale science. So what does it prove? It proves that the El Nino effect of somehow the heating of the Pacific Ocean affecting weather to the east of the western coast of South America, that's east of the Pacific, somehow that concept is completely erroneous. It doesn't work. And so what I did is I proved that conclusively, so I'm announcing that on this show tonight, by complete accident. I mean, this was complete accident. I stumbled across something, and then after I noticed it, I went back again, and I thought, you know, something funny here. And so I went back, during the same trip, and it struck me like a ton of bricks. I was looking at something. Who knows how many other people have looked at this, but I recognize something because of my background, and when I do the release next week, you will understand this is a monumental discovery for the human race. So anyway, that release, the pre-release is for sale on my webpage, but next week's show I'll be concentrating on that particular topic. And this is just absolutely beyond incredible. So I'm not going to say any more about that. I'm going to talk a little bit tonight about some of the other things I discovered. Now, you may know this, but Lake Titicaca, let me kind of give you a pattern of the trip that I took here. I went from Lima down through the coastline, south along the coastline. Then I went up to Cusco, then over to Lake Titicaca, and then southwest back down to the coastline, went through a couple other cities, and then came back up the coastline, which is an awesome drive. I mean, this is the scenery in Peru is unbelievable. The beaches, hundreds of kilometers of open beach where there's nobody. I mean, if you want your own beach, go to Peru. I don't particularly like the Pacific beaches myself, but I was awestruck by the immensity and of these beaches, and just nobody there, nothing there. A few little people, houses, very sparsely populated. Something about Peru is that the people there don't own vehicles. Mostly all the transportation is public transportation. Now, that's not true in Lima. There's a lot of private vehicles in Lima. However, in the countryside, very few people, you don't see cars, you don't see motorcycles like you do in other Latin American countries. You don't see individual vehicles. Everybody takes public transportation. The public transportation is pretty good, actually. Fairly dependable given the driving conditions. And I'll have to say this, Peru has amazingly wonderful road system. You would think you were in the heartland, United States, the roads with a big shoulder, people bicycling, bicyclists go there to go on these wonderful roads. Only in a couple places were the roads not really superior. In fact, I would say they're probably better than a lot of the places I've been in the 50 states. That's how good the road system in Peru. My hat's off to those people, because you do not find that in Latin American countries, typically. You don't find those amazing roads literally everywhere. I was just shocked. So, the point is that the people in Peru don't own automobiles or motorcycles, etc. So you're mainly dealing with truck traffic, a lot of truck traffic. But really, there's times when you go for hours without seeing a vehicle on the road, especially up in the Altiplano and places like that. You can drive for 15, 20 minutes and not see another vehicle coming or going. It's pretty incredible. So, but then it's, of course, very dangerous. Cut back mountain roads. The buses can't make those turns, and so they're in your lane. It's quite a deal. You know, 3,000 kilometers in 11 days in a vehicle driving is, you get done with that, you've seen some mountains, you've seen some territory, let me tell you. But at any rate, those were the two main reasons why I went to Peru. Now, something else that I picked up on is that Venus, now we look at the Maya, we look at the Aztec, Venus is central, especially to the Maya, is very central to the religions. But so I want to compare the Incas and the Aztecs and the Maya a little bit here. The Maya predated the Aztecs, of course. At their heyday, they were probably 800 AD to about 1100 AD. They were still in existence. This is the Maya. They were still in existence when the Spanish came. But they were highly developed. They had a highly developed language, mathematics, astronomy, predictive ability. Their architecture was very much oriented towards astronomy, archaeoastronomy, etc. The Incas Not so much. They were more interested in advancing their civilization, in social economics, etc. Here's the way the Incas lived, and I find it very interesting. They had three rules. They kept things fairly simple. You didn't lie, you didn't steal, and you weren't lazy. The Incas were all given property. They were all private property owners. That was part of their culture. You owned private property, and this the emperor made sure of that. So you grew your own crops, your family lived there, they had a place to live. And 20% of your time was dedicated to public projects. That's allowed them, with 16 million people at the height of their population around Cusco, that's where the central capital of the Inca Empire, which extended far up into Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Uruguay, what is now Chile and Argentina, they expanded through all of that and Brazil. They had, the Incas had road systems, trading, etc. They had various levels of architecture in their buildings. But they 20% of the time of the populace went into work. The women cooked and provided the food, etc. The men did the heavy labor. And I have a picture. You know, there's this question of how did they move these massive 70 or 100-ton rocks around? And I have a picture, which is from around the turn of the century, where there's a group of Inca, dressed in Inca garb, moving these massive rocks with ropes, with levers, with wood rollers and rock rollers, and that's how they moved these. They used ramps, etc. And some of these rocks have up to 30 different angular cuts in them where they meet perfectly. You can't get a razor blade in between them. There's no mortar. There's no caulking or glue of any kind. These rocks are cut, massive rocks. And they were able to move these and put them together and build these cities. So they had three levels of architecture. They had kind of the common man's architecture, which was just piling rocks up. Of course, they have plenty of rocks there. And then the second tier was taking rock and building up with clay. And those walls are still there today, just like they were there, you know, 500,000 or 1,000 years ago. But the Incas did not carry over like the Mayas. The Mayas carried their mythology of Venus and the sun and the destruction of Earth and all of that. The Mayas carried that forward from the Olmecs, which lived around 1500 BC and then prior. Let me just say this. The Earth was heavily, heavily populated prior to the Venus event and then prior to the Noah event, which was thousands of years earlier, the Venus event being the same as the Moses event. And these, when large comets passed by Earth, the Noah flood was caused when we passed 40 days and 40 nights through the comet, large comet tail. We don't know much about that comet, but we do know a lot about the Moses event, the Venus event, and that's the one that the Mayans refer to. Venus is still central in the Inca mythology, but it's not as dramatic. It's like they kind of lost touch with the ancients, the ancient people. And anyway, when I do my release next week, some of this will come back into play. Some of that connection between the Incas and what you might call the pre-Incas and the very ancient cultures there. And this is very important to understand. And that's why when I discovered this, what I'm going to announce next week, my new release, it had to be someone like myself who's been around the block, who understands what comets are, how they to partake in the development, the social development because of the disasters and the remembrance of these disasters in the history of these various people and how it plays out between, say, the pre-Olmec groups in the Central America and southeastern Mexico coming up to the day of the Maya, versus the pre-Incas coming up to the days of the Incas. And then also the Aztecs they came later, although they took a lot. They were the equivalent of, say, the Romans taking information from the Greeks. They took a lot of their information from the Maya, the Aztecs did. When the Spanish came, there was vast amounts of gold, especially the Aztecs and the Incas. This was stolen by the Spanish. And by the way, there's a little untold story. I like to include this because this is not in your history book. When the Spanish came, their ships were built of woods that were obtained in Europe. Those woods did not last. They didn't fare very well in the tropical waters because of the worms. The worms that get into the wood and basically eat it, almost like termites, but they're worms that are in the water. And so the Spanish soon learned that the tropical hardwoods were resistant to that. So when they built, for example, the Spanish Armada and the English ships, these were all built from tropical hardwoods. Well, they didn't have trucks and roads and chainsaws back then. So the question is, how did they get that timber to the coast and to the shipbuilders to build all that shipping? And this is not part of history. It was through slavery. I'll just bring you up to date with the Incas. About 200 years before the Spanish arrived, the Inca population was at a maximum. That was when they were in their glory days, building the big cities. That's when Machu Picchu was at its heyday, and the city, the central Inca capital of Cusco. But they had a civil war, which lasted about probably a good 50 years or more, estimated, in which half of the population died in this war. It was devastating to the Inca population. So by the time the Spanish came, they were greatly diminished from what they were at their peak. But the gold was still there, the gold that was in... and the Incas didn't value it as money. They valued it as an artwork. As you can see, if you go to some of the famous museums of the world that deal with gold throughout South America or Central America, you'll find that gold was cherished for its beauty, not for its value in, say, money. And so what the Spanish did is, so they could move it, they melted everything down, cast it in what you call pieces of eight. They took a coin, they cast a coin, and it had a cross on both sides representing Christ. So it's one of the dichotomies of history. But anyway, they melted down all of these artifacts, cast them into pieces of eight, or the, as the pirates used to say, doubloons, or pieces of eight, because on both sides, if you have a cross on both sides of the coin, that's divided into eight pieces. So they called them pieces of eight. And so anyway, they had so much of that that they ballasted the ships they built out of the tropical hardwoods, the wood being brought to the coast by slave labor. And so this was all done in the name of Christ and the Catholic Church, and it was okay to do it because these people were pagans. They destroyed these societies. They destroyed the history. They tried to destroy as much as they could, but the Inca structures were built so sturdily that they couldn't destroy them, no matter how hard they pounded on them, whatever. So a lot of the Inca structures still remain. A lot of the Mayan structures and a lot of the Aztec structures were destroyed, and the rocks recut to build temples and churches around, say, Mexico City or around the Yucatan, etc. But anyway, that was somewhat the story of the raping and pillaging of the New World. It's my opinion that that gold and all of that wealth should be put back. The Rothschilds, who stole it, the Vatican Front Organization, should put all of that money, that gold, back, because that is the basis, literally still the basis of wealth that runs the international banking community. I want to turn directions here for a second in the a number of years ago, a guy named Jacques Cousteau had learned from indigenous people that there were some ruins in the bottom of Lake Titicaca. So they went down there and explored them. And sure enough, the bottom of Lake Titicaca, which is at an elevation of 12,555 feet above sea level, it's the highest elevation freshwater body in the world. Like I say, you can take a glass of water and drink it. Many of the people that still live on or around the lake still speak one of the two remaining Inca languages. And they do not speak Spanish, especially some of the older people. Now that younger people are starting to go to school, they're starting to learn Spanish. But anybody that's over 20 years old, probably very few of them actually speak Spanish. They still speak the Inca languages. But be that as it may, there's some artifacts there. One is on an island where there are carved rocks, etc., the remains of archaeological historical work of pre-Incas. There's a city, a stone city, that's at the bottom of Lake Titicaca. And the story is that that is where the pre-Inca people lived. Then there was a great flood. Gee, boys and girls, where have we heard about the great flood before? You know, the scientists that are trying to convince you that the great flood was a dam breaking over in the Mideast and flooding the Mediterranean Sea? Well, how did they explain Lake Titicaca and the city that's at the base of Lake Titicaca, you know, 500 feet underwater, and the water is now on top of that? How do they explain that? Well, Tier 2 science doesn't explain much. They kind of ignore those little other facts. But very interesting. Clearly, there's generations of lost civilizations that have lived in that area. One of the things that Velikovsky reported in his books, Worlds in Collision, Ages in Chaos, and Earth in Upheaval, is that they found seashells on the top of the Andes Mountains in Peru. There's another city in Peru along the coastline that housed around 40 million people. And they really don't know much about the people other than the fact that, and you can see the gridwork, the roads, the buildings, the literally the gridwork of this massive city along the Pacific Ocean, where there's nothing left, not even a potsherd, not even a piece of clay. Nothing is left there. It got washed completely clean by a massive ocean wave that came in, washed the people and everything else away, and all it's left is the basic structure, the streets, the buildings, the stone buildings, etc., of this city. And the estimate is that it housed 40 million people. And this was long before the Great Pyramids in Egypt were built. This dispels any myth that, of course, that once again, the myth that somehow man crossed the Bering Strait and into Alaska from Siberia, and that somehow populated the Western Hemisphere. Complete fairy tale science, but this is the standard story that's still taught in the textbooks from kindergarten on through college. That's why I keep saying, if you go to college, if you go to grade school or public school, 95% of what they teach you couldn't possibly be true. You cannot talk about Peru without interjecting the story of a guy named Thor Heyerdahl. When I lived in Mexico back in the early 1970s, a guy named Thor Heyerdahl came to Mexico City, and he was doing a fundraiser for one of his projects. But one of his major contributions was to associate Lake Titicaca up in the mountains of the Andes and the reed boats. Now, a movie came out, I believe it was about a year ago, called Kon-Tiki. And I have not been able to see that movie myself just because of my traveling and being involved and very busy. But I read the book when the book came out, Kon-Tiki, by Thor Heyerdahl. And also one of my childhood favorite books was Aku Aku, about Easter Island. And so, but anyway, Kon-Tiki tells the tale about how the reed boats were used to cross the Pacific Ocean, linking Lake Titicaca, the Peruvians, with Pacific cultures. And so anyway, won't say any more about that, because that you can look up on your own. Very interesting. So you cannot talk about Peru without talking about the reed boats. And by the way, I got a ride on a reed boat. And that was very fun. But to my surprise, the reed boats only last maybe about a year. And then they have to rebuild them. But once again, just an amazing culture. I wish I had 5 hours to show pictures and talk and discuss everything that happened on this particular trip. But once again, check that out, Thor Heyerdahl. It's H-Y, Heyerdahl, D-A-H-L. I believe he's Scandinavian, Norwegian, and quite an amazing person. The various things he accomplished in his life, and you know, the connections he made where other standard science or archaeology or anthropology failed to see the connections. In the background, I'm going to be discussing in future weeks, I won't give any details right now, but not only in Peru, but in many other countries there where I've been and other associates that have been, we're looking at preserving the way of life of indigenous people. They are being threatened like never before. And so on this Christmas Eve 2015, I'm going to be kind of priming the pump, so to speak, talking about, and I'm in this sense, I'm not asking for money or anything like that. I'm just asking you to be aware and keep your ears to the rails, so to speak, because in the future we're going to be going group by group and making it public. These groups that are being threatened in all over the planet right now. You can't even find one area of the planet where these people are not being threatened, their lifestyle. And they're living in the manner that their ancestors did hundreds of years ago, but modern society is encroaching upon them. So anyway, as we go into this Christmas season, I want those people in your thoughts, the people that are, you know, have the fortitude to continue living like this. It's not easy. There's certainly health issues, but you would think, oh, maybe we should bring them into the modern age. No, it's time that we all step back and went back into a previous age and understand that we have to live with the earth and stop destroying this planet. When I was at a restaurant, this was very interesting, there was a sign, and I asked the owner of the restaurant, and it's basically it said preparedness, and they showed a family, basically the father holding the hands of the children and them with a little pack on, and they were like leaving, obviously like a emergency situation. And the idea was that they were promoting emergency due to climate change, global climate change, El Nino. And so this is being promoted in a lot of countries, that somehow there's going to be an emergency and the people are going to have to depend on the government during an emergency due to climate change. This is being promoted worldwide. This is all a way to bring police states into power around the globe. And so the United States is not the only place. That's what I'm telling you. And these people, you know, they're not scientifically adept people. So when the government says something, they tend to believe it. So it's a very difficult road to try and teach the public that global climate change is a vast lie. It's a control mechanism, and you know, it's being used worldwide. And I saw it right in your face in Peru. Just a quick announcement. This came in just a day or so ago. a lot of people sent this in, and I saw it too. It was hit a major. It got a lot of press. Let's put it that way. It was posted high on the general disinformation, what we call schmooze news, that NASA and Standard Science is now claiming that comets, big comets, not just your average comet, but they're saying a big comet is 40 kilometers across. There's a new class of comets that they are defining that come from the outer solar system that could come in, break apart, and rain down on Earth for a period of 100,000 years and cause severe damage to Earth. And, of course, this is complete theft of Velikovsky's work. Just imagine the denial that occurred back in the 1950s when Velikovsky first came out and said comets could damage Earth and the big comets could come by Earth and cause damage, etc. Then when my work came along and proved using plasma physics that comets are not dirty snowballs, that large comets could become planets, etc., and that they could come by Earth and cause major damage, now NASA is coming along and saying, "Doggone, those big comets could really cause a lot of damage on Earth." And so this, the disinformation is so rampant out there. I have been so successful in bringing my message to the public that the only thing they can do is try and steal it, and then, of course, give it that good old tier two twist, the, you know, let's twist again like we did last summer type of thing, with NASA, chubby NASA in the checkers, saying that comets, big comets, are now a definite threat to Earth. But, the, of course, they have to do the twist and say they have to crash into Earth to do the damage. The real issue is, as I've been saying all along, big comets, I mean really big comets, we're talking Earth or Moon size or Jupiter size even, that come by Earth and cause severe damage, including electromagnetic effects, electrical discharges, interaction with the atmosphere, either taking our atmosphere away or dumping our pollution into our atmosphere, etc. So this is what I call the creeping crud. There, it's like the dog who's supposed to stay outside and is laying at the door, and then he puts one paw in the door, you know, and when nobody says anything, he puts two paws in the door, and before you know it, the dog's sleeping on the couch. That's NASA. That's what they're up to, the creeping crud. Okay, switching gears a little bit. Now, this was, I like to have fun when I go on trips, and I like to do things in special places. So I had planned a project while I was at Machu Picchu. And the result of this is what I call Machu Picchu primes. And, of course, my work deals with prime numbers. This is one of the branches of work that I've been very successful organizing, the prime numbers, defining them, generating them, an equation that actually calculates directly the prime numbers, the generator function. That, of course, came out in 2007 in my book, Calculate Primes. And a sequel to that book is one of the e-books entitled Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit, which shows anybody how to break the encryption codes that are still being used erroneously and by companies and the NSA because they don't want to retool. But anyway, that's another aspect of prime numbers. But prime numbers are also fun mathematically. So while I was at Machu Picchu, I sat down and I set about a project and managed to, let's say, define a new aspect of looking at certain prime numbers. And I call those Machu Picchu primes. So that's something that will come out in the future. It's too complicated a topic to really discuss on the air, but I want to prime you for that. That's going to come in the future. I won't say any more about the conditions of that release, etc. But those are the kind of things that I like to do. Here you are in a place that tremendous amount of centralized energy. Historically, you have the two mountains Huayna Picchu, which is the very famous mountain that you always see with Machu Picchu. And then Machu Picchu is actually the mountain behind the city. And the city of Machu Picchu is built between these. And, of course, these are all Spanish names. We really don't know the details of the Inca names that was all translated and distorted when the Spanish came as they tried to destroy everything in sight. The one thing wonderful about Machu Picchu is that the Spanish never discovered it. They would have probably destroyed it completely if they would have discovered it. But the Spanish never found Machu Picchu. It wasn't discovered until much later, and it was completely overgrown. So when you see it today, of course, there was a lot of work to restore it back to its original condition. So the walls of the buildings, etc. Machu Picchu was a place to go study, to elevate yourself and for higher learning, for astronomy, for studying the religious aspects, the spiritual aspects of people. And that's what Machu Picchu was about. So in an energy place like that, for me to sit down and work on my prime number work there was something extremely special. And so, as I say, the end result was an afternoon of sitting there down below the mountain with my tablet, with my work set up there in the shade because it was a tremendously hot day, working on prime numbers and actually fleshing out this particular aspect of prime numbers as it kind of reflected the architecture of Machu Picchu. Machu Picchu primes, it's something you'll be hearing more about in the future, but just one of those fun moments for me as a professional, being able to travel, sit down in a place, and do some work where a tremendous amount of energy is occurring, has occurred, and obviously a very centralized place for cosmic knowledge. Anyway, once again, you'll be hearing more about that in the future, the Machu Picchu primes. There's about a minute left here, so once again, Merry Christmas to all. Remember that my sales page, the water filter products, will go off sale next Thursday during my show when I announce the new release. And that's something I want everybody to listen to. That's next, actually, New Year's Eve, December 31st. It's now available in pre-sale on my webpage, jmccsci.com. And when you see this and hear it, like I say, this was a complete surprise discovery for me. And I'm very excited. I have not told anybody about this. So it's something that you're going to see and hear for the first time. I have it established in records, and that's why it's taking a while to actually make the release. But go to my webpage, jmccsci.com. I'll be posting some more photos this week of Machu Picchu and Peru. And join me next week for that amazing special release. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. Merry, Merry Christmas, and to all a good night. And we are at the crossroads. Good night.